evening, you guys. I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we run the TechNet 8 o'clock Sunday night for the last 32 years. Let me think now. 34 years. Started 1982. Yeah, 34 years. September 1982 is when it began. This will be TechNet number 1631 of that series. The TechNet might be a record holder as far as the greatest number of hours on the net, the greatest number of years of service under essentially one leadership. Total number of hours of the TechNet that are recorded, you can find that on the website of KC2NJI. Mike Perry has a website that you can get to by going to the address of amateurradio.tangovictor. There you'll find the last 10 years of the 34 years of the TechNet. The last 10 years are recorded. You can choose the right year, the right month, the right week, and you can listen to past TechNets. The TechNet itself that you're going to hear tonight, if it runs as usual, runs for 4 solid hours. Not everyone can stay up that late. And so people will, a few days downrange, go to that website, amateurradio.tangovictor, put it into their portable device, and then listen to it on the train, during their lunch hour, whatever. For the people who do want to listen to the TechNet, and they can't stay up that late. There is a second website that supports the TechNet by Mike number 2, K1MJM, and that's at TechNetLimoc.com. And there you'll find supporting information, articles, photographs, graphs, charts, and so on, which, as I said, support the TechNet. Some of that material is also on the first website. Can we drop? And I know it's boring for you guys to listen to it thousands of times, but there's always new people finding out about the TechNet. I'm amazed that from time to time somebody will say, gee, I'm hearing about this thing called TechNet. What is it? When is it? And so after 34 years, there are still a significant number of people who haven't heard about it. Therefore, they need a little bit of an explanation as to what it is. It's a gathering of curious people who want to know more about their ham radio equipment and how radio works in general. They gather here. During the first hour, we take check-ins of people who do have a question or a comment. We take them in order, and we discuss their questions. People who don't yet have the right ham license, don't have the right equipment so they can talk to us directly. Let me drop. The TechNet is a live, on-the-air exchange among the listeners. Almost any subject you bring up, because this particular repeater covers a good section of the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, somewhere in there is a person who's got experience on the subject of your particular question. They come forward, volunteer their experience, and we hear a lot of what you ordinarily would not hear, things that you don't find in the classes, you don't find in the books, and so on. Ham radio operators are crafty people who find various ways of building antennas and transmission lines and repeaters and antenna tuners and whatever. They find all kinds of crafty ways of doing things, and they give that information to us. So lots of good information passes. Let me drop this. Not everything you hear is perfectly accurate. There are mistakes. For instance, last week I made a rough estimate that a human being consumes 5 pounds of oxygen per day. This came about because Paul, during his space report, was telling us that 100 pounds of oxygen had been brought up. I was making a rough guess as to how many man days that would support. And so Roy, our physician, Roy EC2GS, brought to my attention the fact that I had overestimated for a bunch of reasons, and it's more like 2 pounds per day of oxygen a human being consumes, not the 5 that I had estimated. Of the air that you breathe in, not every bit of that oxygen is absorbed by your lungs. You breathe in 20% oxygen, and something like 13% comes back out of the air that you exhale. But still, you breathe many cubic meters of air per day. In other words, a good-sized room is the amount of air that you consume in one day. Let me drop this. So as Paul would be telling us during his space report, the Progress ships, among many other ships that bring consumables up to the International Space Station. They bring numbers like 5,000 pounds per time. Something like 60,000 pounds of stuff is brought up to the International Space Station each year to maintain the astronauts. So there's an awful lot of things that we take for granted down here on Earth. That the air will always be there, the water will always be there, the air pressure will always be there. The atmosphere protecting you from ultraviolet and X-rays and cosmic rays. The magnetic field deflecting all of those solar wind particles and everything else. There's a hell of a lot of stuff that we take for granted down here on Earth. And you put a man in space and you must maintain all of that. It takes a rather heroic effort. A lot more difficult than you think. Let me drop. So the first hour will be the question and answers of people who sign in with a question. You're not signing in because you're just listening. After 34 years, we have reason to believe that somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be confirmed anymore. That's followed by John, KC2WGB, after approximately the first hour, a very loose schedule, in which John, by way of the mailbag that he maintains, sometimes he gets as many as 78 messages in 1 week, he'll choose five of those of people who, as I said earlier, don't have the right equipment, or don't have the right license yet, to talk to us directly. The TechNet is a live give and take. It is not, in general, a written free consulting service. We're not volunteering that. But if you're willing to take your question on the air and discuss it, the price is right, if you know what I mean. And as I said, not everything you hear is 100% accurate. We try to make it accurate. But talk to any realistic engineer, for instance, and if he's smart enough, he'll realize that he doesn't bat 1,000. No matter how hard you try, not everything you do is going to be 100% accurate. It's going to be a certain percentage of errors. So you can be a little bit careful with that. But it's peer-reviewed material. By that I mean what we say on the TechNet gets recorded. Lots of people listen to those recordings, and our errors get pointed out to us. And most of the time we report those errors. Very similar to Wikipedia, for people who don't trust Wikipedia. I trust it an awful lot. I think it's got 98% accuracy. Again, it's peer-reviewed. When Wikipedia makes an error, somebody will listen to it and make corrections. So the first hour is the question and answers. The second hour, the second period of time, is John KC2WG with the mailbag. The third section of the TechNet is going to be Paul WS2N with the space report. And tonight we'll be hearing space report number 231 of the series. And NASA and the zillions of other international space agencies are always putting up new vehicles. And some of the things that we're looking forward to is the James Webb Space Telescope that's going to be launched at the tail end of 2018. Boy, that's going to be, I hope that works well. It's an extremely elaborate piece of hardware. It's going to be mounted 1 million miles away from the Earth in Lagrange Point number 2. But it's many times bigger than Hubble. And if it's got half the capability that it's capable of, it's going to be a lot more than Hubble. And Hubble, in theory, the Hubble Space Telescope, is arguably the most productive piece of hardware that NASA has ever produced. Let me drop. So there are very many interesting pieces of hardware that NASA is going to be launching, maintaining, and so on. The questions that are appropriate for the TechNet are almost any question of interest to a ham radio operator. We don't restrict that. Also, there are times we get very deep into antennas, for instance, and people think that, hey, this technical net is much too technical for me. And my question is very simple. There's no such thing as a question that's too simple or too dumb for us. There's no such thing as a dumb question. If a person has trouble expressing his question, he doesn't have the right vocabulary. If you think about it, that's the guy most deserving of an answer. Because there's a bigger gap between what he would like to know and what he presently knows. So we claim that we're not so elitist and snooty that we'll say that, hey, that question doesn't come up to our level. We're not going to handle it. So if you've got what you think is a dumb question, but you really got a question, don't hesitate. Come forward and ask it. You will not get chastised on this group. At least not while I'm trying to lead it. Trying to lead this rabble. Let me drop it. And from time to time, you'll hear from Mahal, K6DPZ, who claims to have the quickie answers. And once in a while, he and I have a difference of opinion. You'll hear both sides of the story, and you can decide which side that you like and you think is the most traceable to the Bureau, if you know what I mean. And, alrighty, so we're about to take questions now. I'm about to take check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. So you're going to give me your call letters, followed by your name. Try to remember to give me your name, because I'm very forgetful. I like addressing people by name. It's a little bit more personal. And then you're going to follow that by the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So people who have a question or comment, please give me your call letters and name right now. And in between all of this jazz, try to remember to listen for the four beeps. If you jump the gun and pick up real fast, there's a chance that you're going to be dropped out, if you know what I mean. K2LIs will be listening for people who want to check in right now. Call letters and names, please. K2LIW.
And so we all check with a question.
KD2IXP. John, yes.
Okay, so far I've heard Rich, Blank, and IXP. Who's the person in between Rich and IXP? Who was that?
KD2LYW, Dennis.
Okay, Dennis, LYW. And Mr. IXP, you've, that's John. John, I think it's KD2IXP. Is it K2 or KD2IXP, John?
Kilo Delta 2, India X-ray Papa.
We got you, John. Thank you. So we got Rich, Dennis, and John. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
USHO, John, Mount Laurel, yes.
Okay, Mr. SHO.
Delta Papa Zulu with a quickie answers.
Okay, Hal, I announced in the beginning, as I do every time, that Hal's going to be giving the quickie answers. I please ask you to give me one favor. When you tell us you're going to give us the quickie answers, make sure you know what the question is. If you tell us you've got quickie answers, but you don't know the question, I get letters from people who are saying that that's annoying to hear. So make sure you know the question. Other than that, we always announce in the beginning that the quickie answers are going to be available from you. Mr. SHO, please give me your prefix and name, K2LIW.
Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar, John, Mount Laurel.
Very fine, John. Because your method of getting to us from Mount Laurel has a bit of a delay, we quite often only hear the suffix, if you know what I mean, because you have to squeeze the mic, wait a while for the system to pick up on you, and then we can give you the whole call. So, once again, we've got Rich, Dennis, John number one, and John number two. One last call. Anyone else to check in with a question or a comment for the net? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
W-A-2-R-Y-Y. Joe. Yes.
Fantastic. That guy really knows how to sign in just right. Very fine, Joe. You did it just right. And go easy with it. Sometimes you ask questions that get us going for a solid hour, as you did a couple of weeks ago. And that's a left-handed compliment. It was a darn good question. Rich, N2EO. How are the electrons in Massapequa Park treating you tonight? N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I've been trying to get in. This is George. Everybody's stepping on me. I've been trying to get in from the beginning. KD2FIU.
Okay, KD2FIU. Sorry about that, George. I'm listening on the input as well as the output. And so, if those people were stepping on you, boy, they were doing a perfect job. I never even heard a snicket. You know what I mean. We'll get you, George. Rich and 2EO, go right ahead.
Okay, Dick and 2EO, had a question or a query about jobs professional in the professional field. Just to give you a little insight, I live here with Patty, my girlfriend. Her son lives here, Jeremy, and his little boy lives here, Landon. And the problem Jeremy is running into, he feels he doesn't make enough money in the blue-collar field, and Arthur gets no respect anymore. I suggested to him that he either get into computer science, to go to school, go to for computer science, or maybe even become a school teacher. He's very good. I mean, that'll be set. In the last couple of years, he gained a lot of weight. He's gonna lose that weight, but he used to be a bodybuilder. So I suggested to him also maybe a high school gym teacher. Now, he would need, I think, for high school gym teacher, 2 years of college, minimum, if I'm not correct. And for computer science, if he goes into that, I don't know if he could go with 2 years. They might not accept him. 4 years. And right now he's 36 years old. So he's starting to get up there. So I wonder what your thoughts are, Dick, or the thoughts of anybody on frequency. Because, like I say, one, he's very solid what he does. He works for a company as an exterminator. And he's really not making the money he deserves.
I see the nature of your question, Rich, and this is a tough one. There's no easy glamour fix for this one. In the case of computer science, almost every single high school kid falls in love with his computer, computer games, and he thinks he wants to work in that field. As such, it is my opinion, computer science, engineering science, computer hardware maintenance or whatever, is highly competitive. The people who choose somebody to work in that field try to choose the ones that are highly skilled. And how does one bootstrap himself into getting that high skill in order to be considered of merit in that field and therefore hired? So what I'm saying, I'm not trying to be discouraging. I'm just trying to tell you where I think some of the minefield is. That's a highly competitive field. Teaching. Teaching has got it's a very nice profession where you get a lot of psychic feedback and you can see the results of the effect you have on your students. It's the good news. The bad news is teachers are not paid very well. It takes a fairly long educational process in order to get permanent certification to be allowed to teach in New York State. So that's a tough road to hoe. When you're being interviewed for a job interview, it's very unfortunate, but the first impressions of the interviewer, the first impressions you give to the person doing the interview makes an awful lot of difference. How well you're dressed, what you look like, how healthy you look, and so on, makes a big impression. So if a person is slightly overweight, doesn't have the right education from their point of view, it's difficult to be hired. So these are some of my opinions. As I said, I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just trying to show you where the minefield is. So what's appropriate for Jeremy to seek next? I don't have a great suggestion on that one. The best thing in the world is for a person to work at a job that he enjoys, and therefore he'll put a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of extra effort into it and make it a possibility where he can do well. I'm going to pass it over to the net if anyone else has a suggestion. And you've got a rather tough question there, Rich. There's no simple answer to it. Anyone with any suggestions for Rich, please give me a call at us right now, K2IW in the DECnet.
N2MB with a comment.
Looking forward to hearing you, Barry. And as I said earlier, I'm taking attendance, and you're one of the bedrocks of the TechNet. Awful glad you signed it tonight. And two moon bounce. Please come back anytime you can. Take your eyes up. You got it, Barry.
Okay, I might suggest that education is changing. A lot of people are getting serious, real educations now at home. You don't have to go to school. You do have to go to take a few tests and probably final exams, and there will be a graduation. You have to attend those things. But a lot of this can be done at home now, and you can get on the internet or something. I can actually give them some, I will look it up and give them some help in that area, direct help from me to him. Where to go and what schools that Jeremy might want to attend. Not online, at home. If he's overweight and things like that, this is going to be a lot easier on him. N2MB.
Very good suggestion, Barry. For the last couple of months, boy, do I get hooked. Some particular piece of information I want, I go to the internet, I Google that question, or use some other search engine, but Google is one of my favorites. My son has a number of other favorites. And you'll find a YouTube video that'll give you a lot of information on that subject. And when you're looking at YouTube, at the end of that video you're watching, it'll give you a list on the right-hand side of a whole lot of similarly related subjects. And you start going down that list, and you suddenly realize you're learning more and more and faster, and they're giving you more and more information. And pretty soon, you started off at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, they intended to do this for an hour, and the next thing you know, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and 13 hours have gone by, and because it was so educational, you didn't even realize it. So on the internet, on YouTube video, for instance, there is a tremendous amount of information, so much so that remembering it all and taking notes and whatever is a problem. So if a person wants to educate himself, you can do an extremely good job with the right kind of search engines on the internet. Let me drop. So the good news is you'll have the information, you'll be able to speak the vocabulary, and hopefully you do well during an interview. The one bad thing about that is that it doesn't, in general, it doesn't present you with a credential. If you can go to a job interview and you can flash a diploma or a certificate from an educational organization, of course that holds a lot of weight. That's a slight disadvantage of self-educating on the internet, but my goodness, is there information there. Barry, I wonder if you have fallen into the trap that I have, where you start looking for a piece of information A, and you find A prime, B prime, C prime, and so on, similar information, and pretty soon the clock has gone whizzing by while you're watching all these YouTube videos, for instance. I wonder if you've ever fallen into that trap like I have. N2 Moonbounce, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment.
IXP recognized. Go ahead, Barry, first.
Yeah, many, many times, just like yourself. But I just wanted to point out this education I'm talking about at home is college education. You get real credits, you get a real degree, and these are accredited schools. These are not fly-by-night. You got to watch that. There are a lot of fly-by-night schools that you don't want to deal with. But in Richie's case, I can look up really true accredited colleges that will give you the information at home. You got to come in and take a few tests. You got to do a lot of studying. There's no way out of that. You got to do a lot of reading. You got to take a lot of tests. But you're doing most, 99% of it is at home. And I think that would be good for Jeremy. And 2MB, Rocky Way Beach.
Yeah, thank you, Barry. Very well done. I think comment was John, KD2IXB. If so, wait for the beep and or correct me on the call letters. You've got it, John.
That's correct, Dick. Kilo Delta 2, India, X-ray, Papa. There is an organization, an internationally recognized organization, that issues something called a Certified Instructional Technologist certification. It's very difficult to get, and it does require taking tests. But you can go into this program, take the tests based upon your life experience, if you so choose. And if you pass, you will be certified as an instructional technologist. And that, I have found, is as good as any diploma.
I thank you for that, John. Very encouraging. I'm going to pass it back to Rich and see if he needs any fills on what he's heard so far. N2EO, C2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. Well, what exactly would Jeremy have to do if he wanted to become a high school gym teacher? Does he need 2 years, 4 years? And what does he do to get, I guess, any state certification? And I guess that's pretty much it. What I'm confused about, though, my mother was a school teacher. And we lived in Queens. She taught in a box. And, of course, in the city, it's the Board of Education's unified system. Out here, you've got different, what do you call, every school is a different district. So how does that play in?
I'm going to make a guess. My wife's a school teacher and did so for 30 or so years, both high school and college. The rules have become more stiff now. What your mother experienced then and what the rules are now, the rules are more stringent now, in my opinion. I'm having trouble believing that only 2 years would allow you to get New York State certification as a gym teacher. I'm skeptical of that. Anyone on frequency that wants to correct me as to what's the minimum requirements to get a New York State teaching certification for, say, gym teacher, if you happen to know. K2RIW listening.
Comment, Dick.
Go ahead, Barry. Wait for the beep.
Okay, my sister is a certified New York State teacher. She lives on Long Island. You don't do that in 2 years. That was 4 years. Guaranteed. My brother-in-law is a gym teacher. 4 years, Long Island. So I think that should answer the question.
Answers the question beautifully. Thank you, Barry. So it looks like the teaching pathway is not easy as I see it, Rich. Doesn't pay very well. In other words, the school teacher pay versus the blue collar pay might be awful similar. It's unfair, and there's a huge educational requirement. So choosing the path is not going to be easy. N2EO for a final if you need any more fills, or Rich. K2IW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, thank you for taking the question. It's a little, what do you call it, left of center for what we normally discuss. Yeah, but I'm glad for the comments. I care about him, you know, because he's part of our family. So I'm trying to help him any which way I can. Back to Ned and to Leo.
Yeah, I might want to make a quick comment for Jeremy, and I mean it in a friendly way.
Go right ahead, Barry.
Yeah, Rich, he's got to lose that weight, especially if he wants to be a gym teacher. I'm telling you, he's really got to work on that, and to my brother.
Yeah. My impression is the person who does the interview is extremely influenced by so-called first impressions. So that's something you've got to work on. The next person on my list was Dennis. I'm going to take Dennis, George, and John in that order. Dennis, KD2LYW, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dennis.
Good evening, Dick. TechNet. Hope he's all doing good tonight. I just have a really fast question about my watt meter. I've been checking the wattage on some of my ATTs, and I noticed that when I'm on the 20-watt scale, it's more accurate where it should be, right around pulling 5 watts, or a little shy of 5 watts, let's say 4.5 watts. And when I drop it down to the 5-watt scale, it seems like it's a watt lower. Does that sound like a calibration issue in the meter, or is it because I'm not using a dummy load, or and the adapter I'm using to go into the radio, into the watt meter, etc.?
Okay, there's zillions of kinds of watt meters, Dennis. Are you using a Bird Model 43? And in one case, you're using the the 100-watt full-scale slug, in another case using the 5-watt full-scale slug, as question number one? Or is it some other brand of watt meter where there's a knob on the front panel where you can adjust 100 watts full-scale, 10 watts full-scale, and so on? So what kind of a meter and how are you switching what full-scale is? That's part of what's got to be answered before we can go to the next step. Over to you, Dennis, K2RIW.
Okay, affirmative. Sorry I left out that information. It is an MFJ873. It has a 5-watt scale, followed by a 20-watt scale, followed by a 200-watt scale. Three positions.
Okay, from what you described, and by the way, I presume you're using the exact same load in all three cases. In other words, either this watt meter has a built-in termination. I doubt that. I think it's a through-line type watt meter where you're going into a particular dummy load and or antenna, and you're just flipping the dial and the front panel of the meter and reading what is full scale. If that's what it is, what you're describing definitely is a calibration problem. MFJ, Mighty Fine Junk, is what some people call it. You get a lot for your money out of that company. Let me drop. You get a lot for your money out of that company, but you're not buying a Cadillac. You're not buying something that's perfectly traceable to the National Bureau of Standards, so to speak. So the fact that the accuracy of the scales, the scale factor between scale number one and scale number two has some slippage to it, that's definitely very possible. It's going to happen on every meter. I mean, we'll have to discuss is how much slippage is there between scales. On top of that, the way Dossendow meter type instruments work, if you're using the middle to upper half of the scale, usually, but not always, you get greater accuracy. If you're using the lower edge of a scale, in other words, it's a 100-watt full scale and you're only reading 5 watts of it, you're going to develop a lot more error in the system. My suggestion to you, Dennis, your next question should be, what do I do to correct this? And that is, you visit somebody who has a known Cadillac meter, like a Bird Model 43A, with a known good dummy load. And with his Bird watt meter, you read what power really is coming out of whatever instrument you're testing, and maybe you're going to use other signal generators with your particular MFJ, and then write down what happens. To climb inside the instrument and change your resistor value or change your pot in order to make it read accurately is one possible approach. Another approach is that you make a bunch of measurements by using your watt meter in series with somebody else's watt meter into a dummy load. For instance, let me drop. And you take enough readings and you find out that your 5-watt scale is always 10% low, for instance, or 10% high. So should you correct it, or should you make your own calibration logbook, if you know what I mean? You've got two choices on that one. So the fact that MFJ makes a slightly inexpensive instrument doesn't restrict you. You can make a correction logbook, for instance, and you can, with enough enthusiasm, you could make it have 0.1% accuracy by having a thorough enough logbook and making enough measurements at enough power levels at maybe a number of different frequencies. And there's another thing to worry about. As you change, if you made the watt meter measurement on 2 meters versus 450, you're going to get a different scale. But if you're willing to put forth the time, guarantee with the friendships you've got with this club, there's ways you can find out exactly what that meter is doing and make yourself a logbook scale and or correct it. KD2, LYU. LYW, sorry about that, Dennis. K2RIW. You got it, Dennis. You can ask more questions on this if you want to.
I think I got the idea, Dick. Thank you for the answer. The 220 watt would be probably the most accurate out of the three settings, because it's 5 watt, 20 watt, 200 watt. But you pretty much well summed it up. It probably is a calibration issue. So I will find somebody to compare the readings too. It's a new meter, so I was a little surprised, but I guess Mighty Fine Junk pretty much well sums it up, and I guess the bottom line is more or less you get what you pay for. But pretty much, thank you very much.
Hey, show with a comment.
Yeah, Dennis, when you do your recalibration procedure, you're going to visit somebody who's got a good meter, and you're either going to set a pot inside, change a resistor value inside, or make yourself a logbook of, when I'm on the 5-watt full scale and it reads 3 watts, the real wattage is 3.2, if you know what I mean. You're going to make yourself a logbook. Whatever you choose as a corrective measure, in fact, unless you're enough of a scientist to recognize the difference and you care about where the difference is coming from, please come back and let us know what you discovered and how you went about it, because I guarantee your situation is not unique. There are other people in your ballpark. Rich maybe has been there. Maybe he's got another solution. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick. I had an MFJ meter. I found it totally unacceptable. What I found, you know, like you say, the bird meter is the best. But if you don't have a bird, can't afford one, the Daiwa meters are very good. I have a Daiwa meter here. It's called the CM Charlie Nancy 801. They have three models. One is HF, one is UHF, and VHF. And then they got one for 1,200 megahertz. They're very, very good meters. They're still not totally accurate like a bird, but the closest thing to a bird. Back to net, N2EO.
Okay, so you're suggesting he buy another brand. I wouldn't abandon the MFJ, Dennis. The general design philosophy of how you build a watt meter, there's a strong amount of similarity between a Cadillac and a Volkswagen watt meter. They have very similar principles of operation, but one of them is going to have a little more traceability of its components, a little bit more expense required, a little more accuracy in the way they did the calibrating. So it is my belief that the inexpensive equipment used with intelligence can give you almost all the accuracy that you need. And I think you, with a little bit of effort, I think you can prove that to be true, Dennis. Good luck with that project, and let us know what you discover. Okay, the next person on my list is going to be George, KD2FIU. Go right ahead, George. Sorry you had trouble getting in. K2IW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. KD2FIU, George here. Questions about antenna to feed line impedance matching. And I'm looking for some info to help me calculate various feed line length and type to achieve the 50 ohm impedance match for the feed line of 50 ohms to the transceiver. An example that I've learned of is I can take a 100 ohm antenna device and it can be matched to 50 ohms by taking a 75 ohm coax, cut a quarter wave of the antenna, velocity factored, to achieve the 50 ohms. I'm looking to match 300 ohm lateral line for folded dipoles so that I could feed them at one point to the 50 ohm line to the 50 ohm transceivers. And I'm interested in length and type of feed line to make that approximately 300 to 50 ohm transition.
Okay. You're into an area where you were discussing this at Saturday afternoon on 20 meters. My goodness, would you create a problem with lots of people with lots of opinions. Slightly off to one side is there is an amazing number of people who think if they choose a magic length of transmission line, I'm talking about the 75 feet of line between your shack and the antenna, if that is a magic length, the standing wave ratio will be corrected. With rare exception, that is not true, even though a lot of people think it's true. Now, there is something called a quarter-wave impedance matching transformer. If you choose the right length of coax, if you choose a quarter-wavelength of cable of impedance A, it can give you a significant ratio of input impedance versus output impedance. So exactly electronically, quarter-wavelength of cable can do a lot of correcting. To do that by way of 300 ohms to 50 is a little bit too much, in my opinion. You may not want to choose that particular approach. There's a better one. Let me drop it. There's something called a half-wave coax balun, I think they call it. if you take exactly a half wavelength of any impedance cable, coax cable, half wavelength, and bend it into a U shape, and bring the shields back together, and feed one end of the center conductor with your input transmission line, between those two center conductors, you will get a 4-to-1 impedance step up. So a half wave coax balun, starting off with 50 ohm cable, 4-to-1 gives you 200. So in other words, that device will give you 200 ohms, you feed that into 300 ohm impedance, you have something like a 1.5 standing wave ratio, which calculates to like 2/10 of a dB of loss. It doesn't sound ideal, that's pretty good. If you were starting off with 75 ohm transmission line for your main transmission line, that half wave coax balun, 4-to-1 impedance, would give you exactly 300 ohms. But unfortunately, your transmitter is not 75 ohms. And there's ways you can adapt between 75 and 50 back at the transmitter. So there are various kinds of transformers, balance, and whatever that can do it. So the half-wave coax balance, the big confusion there, let me drop it, is the U-shaped piece of coax, of the half-wave coax balance, the U-shaped piece of coax, its impedance does not matter. That's crazy. Whether you build that out of 50, 75, or 100 ohm impedance, you'll get the exact same result. It is a 4-to-1 step up between your main transmission line going into this assembly versus the balance line, the 300 ohm, so to speak, coming back out. So that's why you'd have to start off with a 75 ohm transmission line for that to be perfect. But it doesn't have to be perfect. In many cases, good enough is good enough. A 4-to-1 step up with that half-wave coax balance, starting off with 50 ohm on your main transmission line, will give you 200. That is a thoroughly balanced structure. It does two things for you, that half-wave coax balance. It takes unbalanced 50 ohm coax and adapts it to a balanced transmission line, the twin lead. And second of all, it's simultaneously giving you the impedance match that's very close. I think it's good enough. I've used that approach many times. The fact that it's got an extra 2/10 of a dB loss because it's not perfect, that's more than good enough, in my opinion. Back to you on that one, Dennis. Correction, John. Wait a minute. It's John. Boy, am I confused. You know who you are. I'm busy. I think it's George. KD2FIU, K2RIW. I'm confused.
Thank you, Dick. It's George, KD2FIU. I'm trying to envision this. The 4-to-1, is that like the hairpin that you would make to feed, let's say, a Yagi, where you're grounding, where you're shielding together at one point, and then you're feeding to one side and shield and coming back, and yes, it's the hairpin that I use on my small 2-meter Yagi. Something like that, and I do have the formulas for that. That would be 4-to-1. Is this what you're referring to with the U-shaped bend?
There's sort of a yes and a no to that, George. A large number of Yagis have a driven element that's fit in this way, and some of them use something called hairpin in a slightly different manner. If I back away from the Yagi for a minute, I'm only looking at coax cables. I choose a chunk of cable of any impedance, coax cable, that is exactly electronically a half wavelength long. I bend it into a U shape. I bring it back on the two ends where I connect the shields together. The two center conductors are going to go to the 300 ohm twin lead. Your input transmission line of, say, 50 or 75 ohms then joins that U shaped object, where the input transmission line is the third shield that gets soldered together. All three shields are soldered together. The center conductor of the input transmission line goes to the center conductor of one side of the U-shape. You feed the U-shape on one side, the signal gets fed all the way through to the other side, and now that half-wave coax balun, a very high-performance structure, reasonably broadband, very simple, inexpensive, high power, easy to build, does exactly a 4-to-1. Whatever your input transmission line is, You'll get exactly four times the output impedance with that. And it does the balancing between the unbalanced coax and the balanced twin lead. So it provides two functions simultaneously, does a beautiful job, high efficiency, and even though it's a 4 to 1, 50 ohms gets stepped up to 200, and you're looking for 300, believe it or not, that's close enough. It's only going to give you about 2/10 of an extra dB of loss because of ISWA. And there's ways you can go one step further and make that a little bit better. But with things that you don't have to go out and buy, you can...
Repeater, time out.
You can easily go out and buy exactly a 300 ohm balanced output to 50 ohm input balancing structure. But you're going to pay some bucks for it. And it's going to have certain power ratings, and you worry about weatherproofing and so on. So with inexpensive structures for your particular problem, this particular structure is very hard to beat. It is very often used, and it's got a lot of track record, a lot of history to it, if you know what I mean, George. KD2FIU, K2IW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. As a matter of fact, I was drawing this as you were going, and I could see it clearly. At the same time, I know I'm going to be having some impedance differences because it's going to be a folded dipole with the 300 ohm twin lead. One of them is going to be dual fed at a phase with two dipoles at the W8KJ, the Krauss antenna, and understandably the impedance would be dropped a little bit as I'm working with a folded dipole, so I might come very close with this 4 to 1 instead of having to go strictly 6 to 1. It may not even start out like that because I'm folding with this, and then I'm going to be outphasing it with a similar folded device, specifically, I don't know, a fifth or a quarter wave away by testing to get some bidirectional gain. This is the idea of it. And plus, I have a ton of 300 ohm rattle line. It's still in the package for years.
Yeah, in my opinion, Dennis, this correction, George, the half-wave coax balance is going to solve your problem 90% of the way. That last 10% of the way, if you want to go there, I've now got the next step for you. If you go to the other website, either website, amateurradio.tv, or you go to limarktechnet.com, and you look for the article by K2RIW of perfect impedance match to a dipole. You look for that article. It's got about 1,500 words, and it's got the world's best kept secret on impedance matching perfectly to any dipole, starting off with any transmission line that you've got. Let me drop. The world's best kept secret is that when it comes to the driven element of a Yagi, all that driven element has to do is give you a good impedance match to your input transmission line, and have the right kind of balancing as far as not feeding extra current down the outside of your transmission line, the right kind of isolation, so to speak. The driven element only has to act like a good impedance to your transmission line and radiate like a dipole. Its exact length does not matter. That's secret number one. However, by way of that article, when you read the details of it, which goes into the other set of graphs, the so-called Brown and Woodward graphs for dipole-like antennas. By adjusting the length of the driven element of your Yagi, you can make the input impedance to that Yagi anything between 1 ohm and 1,000 ohms inclusive. If you want the resistive component to be 67.55 ohms, there is a magic length of the driven element that will give you exactly that resistive component. Unfortunately, most of the time there's a little bit of a reactive component left over, and you simply put a gimmick capacitor across the center of that dipole, and the reactive component disappears. So in other words, with the just information given you by that article. Your German element right now, you believe, is 300 ohms. Let me drop. You can bring that German element down to 200.00 ohms of exact impedance if you want to by following that article. That article has a lot of history. It's a radical sounding idea because you have not read it in any other source. As I said, it's the world's best kept secret. It is being used by the antenna companies that are building the antennas. That's how they figure out how long to make the German element and give the right impedance match. They're using that concept, but not telling the world. I'm telling you. So by reading that article, you can now make the impedance match 90% of the way with the half-wave coax balance, and the last 10% you can make it perfect if you want to by that article. So go to technetlandmark.com and look for the article by K2RIW of perfect impedance matching of a dipole. Various people have come back to me saying, why the hell hasn't somebody told me that earlier a decade ago? I needed that information. KD2FIU, K2RIW. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, Dick. I got that. I'm looking for impedance match to dipole, technetlymark.com. And by the way, I'm envisioning this. I'm seeing it all as you're saying it. But that's where I'm going to get my true matching information, so to say, or how to really trim it up closely after I put the hairpin bend coax together. Excellent. Thank you very much. K2RIW, KD2FIU, back to you in the net, Dick. Thank you.
I'm going to go to my sidekick now. John, KC2WGB. Sounds like we've got a happy customer there, John. John, I think we should send him a bill. What do you think? Over to you, John. I caught him out of sequence. Okay, John number one of the list signed in. KD2IXP. Go right ahead, John. K2RIW. Okay, we'll come back to John later. By the way, once before John signed in, we didn't get to him before he had disappeared. Had to put him number one on the list next week. Now we're going to go to Mount Laurel. KC2SHO, K2RIW. Go ahead, John, number two.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. Good evening to you, everyone else on the net. So a bit of an announcement and a question at the same time. The announcement is that I'm moving. And I'm moving because of the new position. I've mentioned before on the net that I wanted to get back into RF, and I have successfully done it. I will be taking a position at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, supporting the RF systems that drive the linear accelerator. Very cool, very exciting, looking forward to it. Crazy move, crazy new chapter in life, but this brings me to my question. How is it that this RF driver can eventually come to produce high energy proton and neutron streams depending on the type of accelerator and the type of energy that they want? And it also can spit out neutrons and X-rays from this beam. It can't be anywhere near it while it's running, and there's a 10-foot concrete wall all the way around it. You know, about to go inside that wall during the times when it's running. I was wondering if you had some words on that, Dick. K2RIW, KC2SHO.
Yeah, I've got a few words in this one, John. I'm not an expert in this area. Let's take a look at the inside of a vacuum tube. An ordinary vacuum tube, you've got a cathode that's heated, boiling off electrons. You've got a control grid nearby. And if you put a near positive voltage on the control grid, you accelerate those electrons that are leaving the cathode, and you're zooming them toward the plate. And the plate is much higher in positive voltage than the cathode. And if you put a negative voltage on that control grid, you suppress the electrons that are trying to leave the cathode. So that is a one-way accelerator. That is a bulk modulator, the control grid. So by those electrons, you only use them once, so to speak. But you could, if you want to, putting an RF voltage on that control grid so that you carefully time when the electrons go from the cathode to the plate, and there's a resonator on the plate, and now you're acting like a piston that's pushing that resonator, and you eventually develop a great big RF voltage on that resonator. Now, if instead of building a one-way device called vacuum tube, I build a ring, I've got this vacuum ring, and as the electrons pass, I'm going to use electrons, but I'm going to accelerate first, as they pass a particular stage in that ring, where I've got two inner electrodes in there. I've got a circumferential metallic structure with a hole in the center where the electrons with the focusing of the magnets on the outside are going to go through it. So I've got these two apertures side by side. And as the electron goes between those two apertures, if I adjust it in such a way that the left-hand aperture, the one they went through first, is negative...
Repeater, timeout.
The first aperture the electrons go through is negatively charged, and the second aperture is positively charged as the electron is traversing the path between these two apertures. Those electrons will be accelerated toward the second electrode and end up going faster coming out than they went in. And the next time the electron comes around, I repeat the process. So the net result is I'm going to have a carefully timed RF voltage that I put between these two apertures, and I'm giving those electrons a kick every time they go through. Well, I've now shown you one accelerator on one position of this ring. And there's nothing stopping me from putting five accelerators in five different positions. So by putting an RF voltage between two apertures, when you've got a charged particle going through the aperture, you can accelerate the velocity. You can give more momentum to those charged particles each time they go through. Let me drop. I've just shown you how to do it with an electronic voltage put on an aperture. There's a similar one method by which you can do it magnetically, but by various techniques of modulating the magnetism and or modulating the electrostatic potential as your electrons go through certain apertures, you can continuously speed them up each time they go around the ring. And as they speed up, they're now going to develop greater centrifugal force. Therefore, your magnets that are doing the focusing have to work harder. There's a whole lot of things that have to be carefully orchestrated and timed together in order to get your particles up to a high velocity. And why in the world would you want to make your particles go up to a high velocity? Let me drop. It would be awful nice if we can build a microscope with high enough power that we can look inside of an atom. Doesn't exist. You can't do that directly. Then you take the next possible step. You think you've got certain particles inside that atom, and by smashing it against the target at high velocity, it's equivalent to find out how many parts are inside this this pocket watch. In theory, I could smash the pocket watch so that all the particles start falling out, and now I carefully analyze those particles. A very destructive procedure, but it does allow you to find out what's inside the pocket watch. So in the case of atoms that are submicroscopic, at the atomic level, seeing what an electron, a proton, and a neutron looks like is out of the question. But by smashing up against the target and look at all the particles that come back out, by putting them into the right kind of an analyzer, you can figure out what you started off with. What was their magnetic field? What was their charge? How do they move? How heavy are they? So the particle accelerator gives you a lot of information by smashing targets. Now, once you've got this beam, and you aim the beam at a certain kind of a target, what comes out of that target, in some cases, is neutrinos, neutrons, and so on. In other words, of the particles that come out of the target hitting process, by other focusing techniques, you can now choose which particles you like. As I said, this is only a very minor understanding of what goes on inside of a particle accelerator. Congratulations on that job. That sounds like a fun job out there at Los Alamos. And that's a very famous place by way of what happened there at World War II. For people who go to QRZ.com, and you look up KC2SHO, you're going to see a beautiful shack. And now you're about to create something like that out in Los Alamos as I see it.
Repeater, timeout.
And how soon is that move going to take place, John? As I said, once again, congratulations. And what did you have to do to get a job like that? What political influential person do you know? That's a joke. KC2SHO.